Hello and welcome back to part two of our immune system topic. And what we're going to talk about now is what can go wrong.
So before we begin, let's just make sure that you're aware that any of the information I'm presenting here is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. And it's also not medical advice. And when you're presenting to your clients, you need to be really careful and make sure that they are aware that what you're presenting and what I'm presenting here today is intended as a sharing of my knowledge, information, clinical research, and clinical experience over many years. I encourage you, and you should encourage your clients, to make their own healthcare decisions based upon your research and in partnership with a qualified healthcare professional. This is especially true for folks who are on any medications. Just want to make sure that the things that we talk about in terms of nutrition are not going to interfere with the protocols.
We generally can categorize all of the things that can go wrong with your immune system as being either hypoactive or hyperactive. Under the hypoactive, we have infections and immunosuppression, things like AIDS, things that suppress your immune system where you're not actually able to be doing all these things that we talked about. Under the hyperactive category, we have autoimmune and allergy. With autoimmune, we have the different types, and then with allergies, we have food and environmental. So let's dig deep and get into some of these things. So one of the first things that can happen is a weakening of the immune barriers, the gut, the brain, the skin, or the lungs. There's the vitamin D deficiency can create that because vitamin D is important for having the integrity of those linings. Blood sugar irregularities damage those areas. When your adrenals are overactive and you're producing too much cortisol, that can cause problems with the gut, brain, skin, and lung barriers in the immune system. Of course, eating a poor diet containing heated fats, sugar, gluten, and pesticides are all going to get in there and damage the lining. Stress, which is related to overactive adrenal. A prenatal environment. Food allergies and intolerances in your mom can lead to autism, asthma, and eczema. What they found is that undiagnosed and food allergies that mom did not avoid created all sorts of problems in babies, and that in combination with having antibiotics within the first year or two of life is like setting the stage for this person to have long-term atopic diseases like autism, asthma, and eczema. And then of course food allergies damage the mucosa of the lining of the intestine, but then again the damage to the lining of the intestine, leaky gut, can lead to food allergies. So we have this vicious cycle that propagates itself, and we need to avoid foods that you know or your patient knows that they are sensitive to, in addition to healing the leaky gut, in order to kind of stop this thing in its tracks. So let's look at what can go wrong at different levels. Let's start with what can go wrong at the cellular level. Well, we already did the immune barriers, but let's look at the cellular level. Again, not enough vitamin D prevents the activation of your T cells. Remember that when the macrophages grabbed a hold of the invader, they had presenting to that? You need vitamin D to be able to present those antigens. When you don't have enough T suppressors, you have damage to innocent bystanders. So if you're not making enough T suppressors, the reaction just keeps happening long after it should have stopped, and your cells that are in the way get damaged. When you have too many B cells that are made and too much natural killer inside toxic T cells can damage your healthy tissue. So too much activity damages healthy tissue. When you make too many antibodies, you tag innocent bystanders like the thyroid. So for example, if you're making too many antibodies to something else, like say gluten, which has an affinity for thyroid, then that gluten antibody is going to attack the thyroid. Parasites and food allergies, they increase interleukin-4, which causes the overproduction of antibodies. And this could lead to the hyperimmunity diseases like allergy and autoimmune. And then there's cross-reactivities between antigens and body tissue. Say, for example, they call it molecular mimicry. You've got an antigen to, say, dairy protein. It's similar enough on the N3 amino acids to the islet cells in your pancreas. And so you can have an autoimmune disease happening there. And that's type 1 diabetes. Okay? And then you can have an attack of a non-harmful protein. Of course, when things come in, when the invaders come into the system, they're usually like streptococcus. Yeah, you want your immune system to react. You know, overgrowth of a candida. Yeah, you want your immune system to react, right? But do you really want it to react to grass? No, it's a non-harmful protein, but the allergies happen as a result of the immune system being out of balance and getting confused. So any of these can contribute. So let's get started talking about autoantibodies, because that's the heart of it, really. The other stuff is not as challenging, and this stuff is becoming epidemic. So I really want you to be able to go out there and help people who have autoimmune disease. I found a paper, I'm going to give you a link to it, and I saved it. It was basically like, wow, medicine is starting to change, and now it's starting to think that autoimmune disease is curable. So autoantibodies can create to anything. We've seen that, right? It can happen to the thyroid. You can have thyroid peroxidase antibodies or antithyroglobulin. It can be antibodies to the intrinsic factor in your stomach, which is going to affect your B12 absorption. Antibodies against your intestinal tract, Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. Although Crohn's can actually be anywhere in the GI tract, most of the time it's in either the last part, the distal part of the small intestine, or the proximal part of the large intestine. Ulcerative colitis, though, is almost always going to be in the descending colon. If you have antibodies against your pancreas, the islets of Langerhans, that's the insulin-making cells in your pancreas. You can have antibodies in your brain. They've found cerebellum antibodies and Purkinje cell antibodies. You can have connective tissue antibodies, which contribute to a lot of those connective tissue type diseases. You can have antibodies to muscles, to kidney, to skin, to mucous membranes, to myelin, and lots more. There's a document that I want to refer you back to. I'm going to pull it up on the screen right now. And it's an awesome treatment of autoimmunity and how it works and what all the antibodies are. But this is an awesome thing. It has great pictures. It's got great descriptions of what's really happening, the pathophysiology of tissue damage that happens during the autoimmune. But what I wanted to show you right now was this chart. These are all the antigens that actually this test measures. It gives you an idea of what all the different antibodies are and where they can be for. There's parietal cells, intrinsic factors. There's the ones that affect Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. So all of these, it's two pages of antibodies, all of the tissues that can be attacked. Again, I would highly recommend that you read this, and it's a well-referenced article. It's it's 38 pages long, but the last 5 pages. Really cool pictures, too. So the risk factors for autoimmunity have to do with the intake of dietary proteins, gluten, dairy, and anything that you can be allergic to, infection, chemicals, and I would add to the dietary proteins, I would also add dietary constituents that are oxidative, that damage the cells, poor fats, poor quality fats, deficiencies of nutrients. All of these things contribute to autoimmunity as well as stress. So I'm going to show you a little picture I put together to show the overlap of when you have genetics that lean you in that direction. When you have things that alter your immune regulation, like vitamin D deficiency or leaky gut, and you combine that with things like gluten intolerance, deficiencies of nutrients, toxic exposure, stress and infections, the overlap of the three of those will give you autoimmune disease. You may have the tendency to have autoimmune disease, but you live a great life, you eat a great diet, everything's hunky-dory, you may never get it. It's when you get that overlap that things start to go awry. So this is something they go into more detail about this in that Cyrix lab thing. So I recommend if you want to go into more detail, you read that. It's like 38 pages, like I said. So there's a lot of good details. But they talk about something called the autoimmune regulatory gene. And the autoimmune regulatory gene is going to cause the binding sites for the attack to only attack those things that are real. It's not going to allow it to attack your cells in your body. It's only going to let those microbial or food antigens attack what it matches to. So it has these sites that are presented, and it's still on the thymus. And then when you're deficient in these autoimmune regulatory genes, you don't have those binding sites held up, and you get an attack on the various tissues in your body based on the microbial and the other genes that are coming in. So this autoimmune regulatory gene will protect you. And when you don't have that gene turned on, then you're into trouble. Right? That's when the autoimmune sets in. So some common autoimmune diseases that you may have heard of, you may know people with, you may have treated people with, worked with people with: Hashimoto's, thyroiditis, type 1 diabetes, lupus, which can affect systems throughout the body, scleroderma, Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, rheumatoid arthritis, Sjogren's, celiac, multiple sclerosis, and more. These are some of the general trends with T helper cells. If you have a dominance of one type of T helper cell over the other, what you really want to have is a balance between them. And when there's a balance and one doesn't dominate over the other, then the T helpers just tend to, everything stays in check. In general, like I said, this is not always the case. Hashimoto's, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, and chronic viral infections tend to fall under the T helper 1 dominance. The ones that tend to fall under the T helper 2 are lupus, dermatitis, asthma, multiple chemical sensitivities. These are things that are listed as usually helper 2, but it's not 100%. It's not absolute. And what you want to do, if you have somebody who's dealing with this and you need to dig in deeper, you want to look at how do you know what the imbalance, which of the imbalances they're undergoing. Now, if they've got several disease processes superimposing themselves, then there's going to be a fight in either way, and there may not be a T helper dominance. The way that your immune system affects your thyroid related to autoimmunity was the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, the GALT, activation leads to the release of lipopolysaccharide from the gut bacteria, which bonds to an immune complex and then causes the release of inflammatory cytokines. This results in decreased T3, inverse T3, decreased TSH, T3 receptor site resistance. There's all sorts of things that it can lead to, the inflammation, inflammatory cytokines. Remember, we talked a lot about inflammation, and cytokines will affect your thyroid receptors. It also affects the conversion from T3 to T4. Let's just review a few things on testing your immune system for antibodies. The thyroid, you're going to look at thyroid peroxidase, antithyroglobulin, and thyroid-stimulating immunoglobulin, more if you suspect it's in hyperthyroid. ANA is usually related to lupus, but also can be elevated in rheumatoid arthritis. You also want to measure the rheumatoid factor. If you suspect there's a problem with the B12, you might be looking at intrinsic factor antibody. You can be looking at candida antibodies, Lyme antibodies, myelin antibodies, Purkinje cell antibodies, cerebellar, and the more detailed list is in that Cyrix Labs document that I gave you. When you're dealing with somebody who has an autoimmune condition and you're doing what seems to be the right things and you've kind of asked them some questions to help differentiate between TH1 and TH2 based on the nutrients that support one versus the other, based on what they have in their repertoire or what they've tried and had success with and not success with, but you can also do an advanced autoimmune panel. Of course, you want to do a white blood cell count with differential. We're looking at, specifically when we're talking about autoimmune, we're looking for decreased white blood cells because it's very common to have decreased white blood cells with an autoimmune condition. You're looking at the total and the percentages of T cells the total and the percentage of T helpers, the total and the percentage of T suppressors, and the T helper suppressor ratio. You can look at the TH1, TH2 dominance, and there's a series of interleukins, and you look at those, like, I don't have them memorized, but we'll look at the chart. You want to look at the total and percentage of B cells, the total and percentage of NK cells, NK cell activity, and then CD3 and CD26, which is part of the complement system that tend to be associated, and then lipopolysaccharide. I don't run these generally. I haven't had to yet. I would run them if I had to. What I usually do is apply what I know, how to rebalance the immune system, how to get the antioxidants up, addressing any genetic imbalances in the methylation pathways. And generally speaking, I've had really good results with the main autoimmune things I've dealt with are Hashimoto's and the autoimmune diabetes. Gotten really good results pretty quickly. I've also worked with Sjogren's. I've worked with scleroderma, and I've worked with dermatomyositis, which is an interesting one, very, very resistant one, but we got some results with that. And the other one I've worked with was lupus. Lupus tends to respond really, really well to a strict gluten-free, dairy-free, sugar-free regime. And people can really go into remission, and then when they add those things back, the symptoms flare up. Dr. Krasian always says you can't cure these things because as soon as they go back and do the things that caused them, they're going to flare up, but you get them into remission. So you can look at it however you want to look at it. So when we look at the autoimmune and T helper, so the T helper ones are related to IL-2, interleukin-2, IL-12, tumor necrosis factor, and then interferon. Okay, 90% of Hashimoto's is considered to be T1 dominant. You see different numbers in different places. The T helper 2s, interleukin 4, 13, and 10. So you can measure these interleukins in the blood to see if they have a dominance of T helper 1 or a T helper 2 based on that. Now the T helper 17 is related to interleukin 17. I just glossed over it. So food allergies. You can have either immediate or delayed sensitivity. And remember, the immunoglobulins, we talked about IgA, and that's protecting your mucous membranes. That's what you're going to get a reaction to if, say, it's gluten, right? It's not really helpful to measure IgG in a person who's been sensitive to gluten and has stayed away from it for a while or has reduced the levels, because the levels in the blood tend to go down. But where they do tend to arise and stay risen is in the gut. So they're always on surveillance there. Those antibodies aren't going to go away. And so when you measure them in the gut, you get a better response. IgE, again, immediate histamine. I don't see any reason for measuring IgE because of the histamine response. Most people know all of their IgE responses, or at least they can guess. Some, if it's food, they definitely can get it. Sometimes when it's inhalants and it's a bunch of them, you know, grass and mold and pollens and various things, it may be more helpful to do that. IgE is where those typical skin prick tests are geared towards. So you do the skin prick test and you get a wheal and you get inflammation there. That's showing it's a histamine response and it's an IgE. A lot of doctors, conventional allergists, poo-poo the whole idea of delayed hypersensitivity food reactions because when they test their people, they may not have an IgE response when they do the skin prick test. So that skin prick test is not going to be good for hypersensitivities to foods in general, except the ones that the people already know about, and then they're not useful. But IgGs and IgMs and IgAs are more useful in helping to detect that. That said, I've just gotten gun-shy about food allergy testing. I don't do it as much. Used to do it all the time when I first started in practice. All the time. And I get so many weird results. And then I started talking to colleagues, and you're getting weird results with, I just don't seem to find anything useful. And they said, you know, a couple of them told me that they actually did a split sample where they took the same blood, their blood, put different people's names on it, sent it off to the lab to be analyzed, two different labs, got two different results. I've even had a friend who sent two samples to the same lab, same day, same blood sample, different names, she put different names on them, got different results. That says to me that they haven't perfected that science. when you look at the blood and you say your glucose is, you know, 120, that science is pretty clean. We know that we can trust that. Yes, if you bought a $10 meter versus a $500 meter, you may get a slightly different range, but they're really close. They're really close. I haven't found that to be the case with food allergy testing. So people ask me all the time, do you do the ALCAT test? Do you do the IgE? I've done the ALCAT. I've done the IgE. I've done the RAS tests. I've done many of them. What I haven't done is there's a combined IgA, E, G, and M test. It's about $1,400. And the reason I haven't done that is nobody's willing to spend $1,400 to get food allergy testing. And again, we talked about this earlier, food allergies are frequently caused by leaky gut, but leaky gut then causes food allergies. So you have to deal with both. You know, when I was going to school and we were taught about some of this stuff, it was like, oh yeah, take them off their allergens. But they didn't really talk about leaky gut. And then people started talking about leaky gut more. But people have come in to see me, yeah, I got this allergy test tonight, stayed away from these foods for a few months. And, well, what did you do about your leaky gut? What? I didn't do anything. What do you mean? So there's a lot of practitioners who aren't doing it. You can't just take people off their allergens. You have to heal their leaky gut. So some of the lab tests for food reactions, the skin tests, obviously, for inhalant allergies, those can be helpful. Food intolerance, the ALCAT, the blood antibodies, the stool antibodies, the saliva antibodies. Haven't found the saliva antibodies to be all that helpful. And one of the things I find with the saliva, and even sometimes with the stool, if the person has low secretory IgA, and that usually happens as a result of long-term problems with the stress response, overreaction of cortisol can damage that. If they tend to have low IgA, then I don't trust the saliva antibody tests, because then they'll also show low secretory IgA to the particular gluten possibilities. So I've had people who know that they're allergic, very sensitive to gluten, have even had the stool test done, and I've not seen a correlation, a one-to-one correlation between the stool and the saliva. So be careful with those when you do the ASI test from diagnostics and they say, oh yeah, this person doesn't have gluten antibodies. I don't think the sensitivity level is as good as in the stool. And you can falsely tell somebody they're okay, they can eat gluten, and then find out that they're reacting. Okay. The stool test I love is Internal Labs. They used to include the gluten antibodies on the test from Genova Diagnostics. Genova, and I think Metametrics as well, used to include it on their comprehensive gut profile, their stool test. And they no longer do that, so I'm not sure why they don't do it anymore. There's also gluten cross-reactivity tests, the Cerex Labs. Again, they're blood tests, so I use them with a grain of salt. And autoimmune panels, the Cerex Array 5, which is just tells you all the antibodies that you have. These are all things that you could do, because if you have an autoimmune disease, you're most likely going to have some food reactions as well because of the damage that it's doing to your barriers. So an elimination diet, that to me is the best way to tell, although some people don't have the patience for it. For some people it's too confusing and too confounding. But I find that if you can eliminate the suspects for at least 4 days, preferably 7, you can either do fasting or you can put them on what's called a medical food supplement. It's a hypoallergenic formula, assuming you know that you already know that they're not allergic to anything in there. And the other thing is a rare foods diet, rare foods diet. Dr. Elton Haas talks a lot about the rare foods diet in his book on food allergies. It's the false fat diet book. I like that book. And the rare foods diet is basically, you get a food frequency list from the person and you look to see like, okay, what are they not eating on a regular basis? If they have these symptoms that come up periodically, or these symptoms that are there pretty consistently, and there's certain foods that they don't eat more than a couple of times a year, it's unlikely that those foods are contributing to their problem. So you put them on this rare foods diet for that same 4 to 7 days. And then the big thing that most people mess up on is the provocation, the protocol for doing provocation, meaning reintroducing the foods. Some people just go, oh yeah, I added this, and then I added that, and then I added that, and then 3 days later I didn't feel so good and I don't know what it was. You add only one food at a time. You could shortcut this by doing the lowest suspects and doing them a group at a time. But if you have a reaction, you're going to have to go back and do them one-to-one. But say you like, I always eat brassicas. I feel great when I eat brassicas. I don't think that's contributing. Then, yeah, you can just introduce a meal that has, you know, 3 or 4 different brassicas. You know, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts. Because sometimes people are anxious to get their food back up just so that they're having a reasonable amount of food to eat and a reasonable amount of choice. So that's another way you could do it. You could do it one food at a time or one food group, related food group at a time. But you still want to do the 3-day rule. You add the food, you eat a lot of it, or the group of foods. You eat a lot of it for 3 days. Every meal, 3 times a day, you're eating that food unless you get an adverse reaction. As soon as you get an adverse reaction, you stop and you put that food on your suspect list. Okay? If you don't get an allergic reaction after 3 days, you're still feeling as good as you did on the rare foods diet, then you go ahead and put that on your safe, or that group of foods on your safe. Now, this assumes that somebody's getting improvement. They may have to stay off the suspects for longer than this. They may have to stay on a rare foods diet or a medical food process. And when I say medical food, I'm thinking things like Ultra Clear and things like that were designed for it, but although there are better choices these days. So assuming they get better, so if after 4 or 5 days they're going, wow, I haven't felt this good in my life, then you can allow them to introduce things back. But if they say, well, I think I'm a little better, but I'm still getting my headaches, this isn't going away, that you extend that a little bit longer to allow the antibodies to die down. If it's gluten can actually take longer before people see a complete result, because the gluten antibodies have been shown to stay around in the system for up to 6 months. 6 months, that's ridiculous. The provocation protocol, remember, one food at a time or one group at a time. You make a decision when you're dealing with people to say whether the group is all right or the single food. The 3-day rule, you eat a lot of it for 3 whole days. People love this when they're adding back one of their favorite foods to test, but they don't love it when all of a sudden they were feeling great and now they're feeling bad again and they go, oh gosh, I got to give this up. But you really need to have them do careful monitoring. Give them the forms. I have all the materials you need. I have checklists and charts and things that you can do. So if you go through that yourself, you can glean what information, what materials are going to work for me to share with people. Some checklists, a reintroduction sheet. I mean, it's easy enough for you to make, but you know, they're there for you to use if you want to. Okay? So the FAST materials provide all the guidelines. It's really, really critical. Blood antibody food tests. They measure antibody titers to specific numbers of foods. They usually measure IgG or IgG and IgE. Some labs offer IgM and IgA. There's mixed reliability. When you do it at certain labs that have the full, it's 4 different antibodies that they're measuring. What I find is that there's mixed reliability. I remember when I first started doing these, it was said that it was something like, it was about an 80%er. So you got 80% of the results you got were good, and then there was some false negatives and false positives. But it's really challenging if they do this and then they go off all these foods and they don't see any results because it missed some of the things that they were allergic to. What's worse is when you have somebody you suspect that they're allergic to dairy and gluten and all these things, and they go off of them and they feel better. And then they have the test run, and the test says they're not allergic to those things. And then it's really hard for you to convince them otherwise. To say, look, don't trust the test, do it, trust your body. And you have to go through and they have to actually experience it for themselves. So, you know, testing, take with a grain of salt. You may find a lab, I haven't done it in a long time, there may be some better labs, more reliable labs these days to do it with, but, you know, make your own decision. And the thing about blood antibody testing, it's not easy to do. If you don't have a license that allows you to draw blood, then you have to send them off to a lab. Now, I can draw blood in Texas, only I wasn't trained because I was trained in California. And in California, chiropractors can't draw blood, but in Texas they can. So I'm legally allowed to draw blood, but I don't have a clue how to do it. I'd have to take a class in how to do it. But it makes it difficult because you order the kits from a lab, it's usually not a local lab. You have to get them to send them off to a local lab, have a relationship with a local lab that will draw their blood, or a local nurse practitioner or something like that that will draw their blood and then send the vials in for them. So it becomes a little more challenging. The stool test's really easy, they can just do it at home. So the other things, we've talked about this before, you know, the basic blood testing of your immune system. You want to look at your CBC, the white blood cells, the differentials, the fasting insulin, fatty acids, really critical for immune system. We looked at lots and lots of case studies of those before. Arachidonic acid EPA ratio, really highly indicative of the degree of inflammatory and immune response that's going on in the person's body. Triglyceride HDL ratio, that's more related to the insulin resistance, but insulin resistance will tend to create inflammation and cause a hyperimmunity. C-reactive protein is a marker of inflammatory response. If a person's in an active autoimmune or active allergic response, they may have an elevation of their C-reactive protein. You can also measure cytokines and interleukins, and then the SED rate, which is another inflammatory marker. The CRP, if you do the HS, is more sensitive to the SED rate. The SED rate does tend to be elevated in autoimmune diseases. The CRP will tend to pick up things in a more subtle range than the SED rate, and it's used for more overall inflammation. So those are some basic blood tests that you can do, and those you can do through direct labs. I'm assuming that some of the food allergy testing is able to be done through direct labs, which means that you could then have them order the test that way and then take it into the local lab to get done. That's a possibility. The optimum AAEPA ratio that you're striving for is between 1.5 and 3. It's considered unwell to have a ratio above 10. Guess what? The average American has a ratio above 10. I would say, without exception, every one of these that I've done had a ratio of at least 10. In fact, they've been so high when I've done them that when somebody has a 10, I'm kind of, wow, they're not so bad off. Interesting. The average American is around 11. People with things like MS, they're in the 20s. People with autoimmune disease, it tends to be up in the 15s and 20s. So it's really important for you to intervene. And this is a really easy place to intervene. Easy from the standpoint of what to tell them to do. Not so easy to get them to actually do it, because it really means doing an oil change in the body, really replacing the fats with some other